Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack. They come by every couple months to talk with us. David, of course, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to see you again, David. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having us on, Larry.
And Jamie Knack. Jamie, of course, is an outreach wildlife outreach specialist at the UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And Jamie, great to see you as well.
Hey, it's always great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
And I know we have listeners who have questions for you, and we can talk about the whole range of wildlife. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Maybe you've had some experiences with deer. Maybe you've had them with coyotes. Maybe you've had them with wolves. Maybe you've had them with northern pike. Who knows? That's the whole range right there.
It is.
I think pretty much.
Yeah.
Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I wanted to start by taking a look at what's called the Deer Management Assistance Program. It's been getting a little news lately, Jamie.
It has. There's some deadlines coming up and some opportunities to really get involved. But DMAP, as the acronym spells out, is a cooperative effort between the Department of Natural Resources, landowners, and hunters. And the goal is to provide habitat and deer management assistance to those landowners, and particularly the ones who are interested in managing for wildlife on their property. And while the program really talks about deer management and a healthy balance of deer population and habitat features, obviously this management that goes on these properties is going to affect a number of other wildlife species. So the program itself provides landowners with wildlife habitat management resources, and you can have a property of any size to be part of the program. There are different levels for involvement. There's a level 1, 2, and 3. And at the lower end, at level 1, just the entry, if you have relatively small acreage, you can get in on that, get access to a number of resources on the DNR's website. You get annual DMAP reports, and you get an opportunity to attend a number of workshops that they put on an annual basis. At the higher levels, they require 160 in level 2, 160 acres. Level 3, we're looking at 640 acres. And the reason for that is we can't really effectively manage deer on 40 acres. They're a species that requires more acreage than that. So the state is really looking at building cooperatives. And if you don't own 160 acres, you can reach out with your neighbors and form a cooperative and then enroll in the program. At the higher levels of enrollment, there is a fee. For instance, level 2 is $75 for a 3-year enrollment requirement. And what you get by that, or with that in return, is a lot. You get an on-site visit with a wildlife biologist and a forester. They'll walk the property with you and give you some specific habitat management recommendations. You'll have a conversation, a cooperative conversation, in terms of what the deer management goals are, whether we should increase or decrease numbers on that particular property. And you can get a reduced price for antlerless tags when that is a recommended goal or suggestion for habitat. It's important to know, though, that there are not specific management requirements. This isn't a biding like the Managed Forest Law Program. This is just providing information. Again, you get site visits by professionals, and you can kind of take the information from there and use it as you see fit. I guess I'd like to just kind of leave folks with an upcoming opportunity to learn more about DMAP. There's going to be, the Department of Natural Resources will have a chat on February 11th at 12 o'clock. If you have not participated in these chats, either while they're going on and posted comments, or just watched them and looked at them, they're really interesting. And there's one coming up on coyotes maybe we'll mention in a little while here. Mm-hmm. But this one on DMAP, again, it's February 11th at noon. If you go to the DNR's website and in their search box just type in DMAP, you'll get to, or chat. You'll get to either information about the program or the upcoming chat that'll be broadcast. Those chats are also archived, so you don't have to tune in at noon. You can go back weeks later and take a look at the information. But if you're a landowner in Wisconsin...
Sounds like a good deal.
It's a pretty good deal, so definitely check it out and talk with others. I know in just the few short years the program's been underway, they've had really high satisfaction rates, and they've had over 750 landowners that they're working on, working with.
And we should emphasize that even though it's the Deer Management Assistance Program, it really is encompassing all wildlife on the property. And so they do focus on deer, but a lot of times when you manage for deer and deer habitat, it does benefit other species. And they also will, when they go out to visit with landowners, they'll also talk to them about a broader wildlife spectrum than just deer as well.
And you wouldn't even have to be a deer hunter, frankly.
No, not at all.
Nope.
And there's, like, for example, invasive plant species, that's something that would be noted. They look at, browse from a deer, standpoint. So if tree regeneration is important to you, that's something that they will be, looking for, as well as, invasive plant species, and provide you some recommendations on how to control them.
Lots of good stuff there. So I'd go to the DNR website. We probably have a link up on our Facebook page. I bet we do. But if you go to Wisconsin DNR, you get right there. Jim in Superior has a question, so let's go there. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing, Larry? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I got a question about predators. I live up in the woods here, and we've got a lot of predators here. I've got on the camera, I've got 4 and 5 bobcats coming around at a time. And recently, in fact, 2 winters in a row, I've had a wolverine visit my little farm I got, and ate a goose right through bulletproof fence. It literally ate it through like a spaghetti sieve. And the next day, I snuck out there, and there he leaped over my 6-foot fence and was gone. And he had eaten and three-quarter devoured a large turkey. And after the third visit, I decided to get DNR involved. And, they didn't want to believe any of it. We have no wolverines here. Now, he's been here 2 winters in a row. I actually got a casting of some of his prints he left behind. And, they were as big as your hand and claws like your fingers. And, I live here because I enjoy the animals. I don't want to kill the animals. But, boy, we've got a lot of serious predators here.
You should have you got a trail camera?
Yep, got a camera up. Yep.
Did you have you got a photo of him yet, or?
Not of the wolverine, only of all these bobcats I've got. And it looks like the African savanna out there at night.
getting pictures of bobcats is pretty neat to begin with,
and
so that's nice to have that on the camera.
So Jim. The history of wolverines in Wisconsin, I mean, just in terms of what's been reported or confirmed, we have not had a confirmed sighting of a wild wolverine in the state in over 100 years. So that is why there's some skepticism, coming from the state agency. There have been reports of wolverines. The one that I'm familiar with down in the southern part was tracked back to an escaped animal from a zoo. But what I would suggest to you is that there are a lot of predators, as you mentioned. Certainly bobcats, fisher, badgers would have the long claws and could certainly be in your area. The domestic animals that you have are a draw for many predators, both during the day, at night. Aerial predators, predators that are tied to the ground or terrestrial. The best thing is, as Larry kind of alluded to, is to put up a camera and see if you can't capture an image of an animal close to the fence. That might help solve it. Or when you do get those prints like that, put a ruler in the picture, especially if you've got fresh snow right now. Put a ruler in the picture and document the pictures with some sort of size reference, whether it's a pencil, a pocket knife, a ruler if you have one handy. And then with that information, hopefully taking that to the biologist, or you can email it to David or I or the show, and we can get you some identification. So in the world of wildlife, we never say never, but this one would be very unusual to have a wolverine. They just have not been reported in the state. But
seeing a wolverine is like seeing a zebra.
I understand.
You know what I mean? And it's my boy was there, and in fact, another neighbor boy. So we all three seen this monster, and it was knee high.
Yeah.
A big one.
Well, Jim, I would maybe suggest looking at Fisher to begin with and go from there. And keep in mind that in the snow, you know, snow is a wonderful medium to capture tracks. But also in the snow, those animals are spreading their toes a little bit to kind of get a little bit more surface area and hold themselves up on top of the snow. And so the track, it may be a little bit larger in width, for example. It might be a little bit larger in length because the animals, as it plants, it may slide its foot a little bit in the snow because that snow is slippery. And so the track may appear larger than it is, you know, in a non-snow type environment. But I think, as Jamie said, wolverines just are not, I mean, they haven't been documented here in so long. And your more common predator, especially where you live, it would be a fisher.
Yeah, but I would really
I'd set that camera
up. You would be
You'd be famous.
You'd be famous if you got a shot of Jim of a
that's right
wolverine. Yeah.
And
that
we
would
heard
be
it
really
here first.
Something that would really be something. Anyway, thank you so much. I've got lots of other callers online here with questions, so we'll move on. But again, I appreciate your call, and I hope you get a picture. Jamie in Nakusa up next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have just a comment, something that I saw on Saturday heading toward Toma. I was between Babcock and Mather, and you're talking about animals on the ground. This was a bird. This was a, when I looked it up online, it apparently was a black vulture. And he flew out of the woods. I mean, he had a wingspan of probably 6 feet and landed on the side of a tree. Underneath the wings were the white stars, as it's described online.
Yep.
And there he was. I've never seen one before in this area. I looked up in the map, and they don't come this far. So I think he's out of his territory, but it was really interesting to see.
Oh, you know, Janie, I would maybe suggest instead of a black vulture, because black vultures, they are pushing further north, but they're much more east than Wisconsin. So the vulture we would have here would be a turkey vulture. And with this warmer weather and warmer winter, you know, the animals are starting to come back a little bit sooner than they normally do. And so a turkey vulture would be a possibility. But a turkey vulture, with a black vulture, the whites are, as you're looking up, as the bird's soaring, the whites are at the very ends of the wings, whereas with the turkey vulture, the white is all, it really extends on the back half of the wing along the entire length of the wing. So I think turkey vulture would be a possibility, but the other bird that you might have seen is either a golden eagle or an immature bald eagle. And you might want to look at those two species as well.
Like a star pattern under each wing.
Yep. So immature bald eagles will have what we call, refer to them as kind of white armpits. And so they'll have a white patch under each, where the kind of the wing meets the body.
No, this was at the end of the wings.
At the end of the wings. And so you also may want to look at a golden eagle, as well as perhaps an immature golden eagle. But those three species, either golden bald eagle or turkey vulture, are probably more likely than would be a black vulture.
Well, he was big, I'll tell you, and he landed sideways like a woodpecker would on the side of a tree.
Well,
like he hooked onto the side of a tree, and
the other option from that kind of description would be a pileated woodpecker, which is, you know, pileated woodpeckers are about a foot tall, and they have white backs that you see when they're flying, and so maybe look at a pileated woodpecker as well. But you know, a pileated woodpecker, you would not necessarily confuse that with either of the eagle species or a turkey vulture. So I would look at those four species and see if any one of those four are what you saw.
Yeah,
I'd never seen anything like that before. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Worth it to take a look and see what else is there, because it's fairly unlikely that it would have been a
bird. It would be, yep.
Yeah. Chad in Sparta, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question was, I've been hearing rumors that that starting this next trout fishing season, the DNR is going to extend the closing day from October 1st to October 15th. I was wondering if that was true, and if it is true, would that affect the trout population? Because now you're going to be able to fish getting into spawning. their spawning season.
Yeah, Chad, we really don't know anything other than wildlife, to tell you the truth. I mean, that's about the extent of our knowledge. So I will say, though, I do trout fish, and I've not heard anything like that. But typically, any time that a season is going to be extended, or perhaps the bag limit is increased, or whatever the case might be, by the regulatory agency, that typically they don't do that unless they're guaranteed that an increased harvest will not hurt the sustainability of that population or of that species. So if by chance they are going to extend the trout season, I'm sure that they've looked at the science of that, and they would not have done that had the population or the species not be able to sustain the extra harvest.
There may be somebody from DNR listening in. We can them call that, in. So stay listening.
Yeah, that or Chad, just contact your local fisheries biologist for the state and just ask for the explanation. So they'll give you the straight scoop.
Yeah. Or again, stay listening. There may be somebody from DNR listening and call in. Don and Iron River up next. And Don, we'll get to you in just a minute. But just to remind you as you listen in, our two guests today, Jamie Nack and David Drake from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and the University of Wisconsin Extension. Our guests here, Breanne Chasso, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we take a look at the world of wildlife with our guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. And just a reminder, a mention on the Kathleen Dunn Show, that's at 2 o'clock today, John Munson hosting that, and he'll be talking with a Washington Post reporter and a researcher at the Justice Policy Institute about how the for-profit prison industry influences legislation and impacts the justice system. That's at 2 today. Right now, zeroing in on wildlife in Wisconsin, Donald and Iron River up next. Hi, Donald.
Hi. Larry, hi, and your guest. Hey, a couple weeks ago after snowfall, I had footprints, paw prints in the snow. I couldn't tell what they were. I thought it was between a coyote or a wolf, but there was a big tail dragging behind it. So we figured out it was a bobcat. I'm sorry, not a bobcat, a cougar.
Well, Donald, it certainly is a possibility. We have documented cougars in the state. If you listen to the show long enough, it comes up fairly regularly with sightings. Typically, the cougars that have been confirmed through trail cameras. So just thousands and thousands of trail cameras being used across the state. And that's where people typically end up documenting and being able to confirm a cougar's presence. We can confirm with tracks or sometimes through DNA evidence with scat, or if there happens to be blood, cougars have been confirmed. So again, as we talked about with the last caller, if you can take a photograph with a ruler and send that to the local biologist, this
photograph
is
of the track.
This is a species that the state would like to keep tabs on and know about these occurrences because they are not all that common. And another good thing to do is to cover that track so that you can preserve it as long as possible. So if there's going to be another snow event or rain and so on, it's just go ahead and put a Rubbermaid tub or some protective covering over the track in case the biologist wants to come out and
take a look
at it. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks,
okay,
Don.
One other question.
Yeah.
When hummingbirds migrate, I don't know if you know this, but how far do they migrate in a day?
It depends on where they're going, but if they it's not uncommon for hummingbirds to migrate across the Gulf of Mexico from Florida into Texas, and that is a 600-mile journey or something of that nature. And so,
after they cross that barrier, how many miles a day do they start coming up north?
Probably really depends on a number of factors, like the weather, for example. As they're coming north in the springtime, they're not going to fly against the north wind. They're only going to fly when they have a southerly tailwind because it aids in their movement north, but it also doesn't decrease the amount of energy stores that they've got versus flying into a headwind, for example. So it weather patterns will dictate that a little bit. The climate and the warming of the spring as they go north in latitude will dictate that a little bit, and based on if flowers are starting to flower and pollination their food sources available and things like that. So there's a number of, it really depends on a number of factors.
super. All right. Hummingbirds and photographs. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And those hummingbirds, I know once they get across, I mean, they're landing.
Yeah.
Quickly.
Yep.
Right away.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. If you're on the kind of the west side of the Gulf Coast of Mexico, there have been documented what these call these great fallouts, where birds are so exhausted after, and as soon as they hit land, I mean, they literally just fall out of the sky, and birds are just littered on the ground and in the bushes and trees on that western shore of Gulf of Mexico. And it is a pretty interesting phenomena.
Yep. And they'll, you know, most of them will come out of it. I mean, they'll sit there and rest.
Yep.
And
yep.
Let's see. By the way, you can join in. We finally have open lines again. So if you have a question or comment, give a call at 800-642-1234, and we can get you on pretty quickly. Thomas in Manitowoc up next. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. I just wanted to tell you that I'm not against wolves when I make my comment here, but as we've all recently heard in the news, there were three elk that were killed in a three-day period over in Jackson County.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, from an economic standpoint, when you go through all the work of bringing the elk over from Kentucky, wouldn't it be a better idea to hire a professional trapper and maybe remove some of the wolves from that area, or pick up roadkill and place them all over that area so the wolves would have enough to eat? And I was just wondering, how many wolves are in that area that they killed three elk in 3 days? How many wolves would it take to consume that many?
Hmm.
Well, Thomas, just for a little bit of background, in terms of the news release or the information you were referring to, but Jackson County is where a new reintroduction effort is going on for a second herd of elk in the state. And last August, the Department of Natural Resources brought 23 elk into Wisconsin and released them in the Black River State Forest. And since that time, there have been six mortalities, four by wolves, and as he mentioned, three of them just recently in January, and then two by vehicles. And right now that herd consists of seven bulls, seven cows, and three calves. And I guess to answer or address some of your suggestions there, first of all, the project, the wolf or the elk reintroduction project, is certainly aware that wolves are in the area, and that was something that was discussed early on with the reintroduction efforts. The project also certainly expects losses as we bring elk into the state. We expect there to be mortalities. So when they set their goal for the 75 elk into Jackson County, that was kind of all taken into account. So it's a setback, and yet it's sort of an anticipated setback as well. So moving forward, as far as relocating wolves, they are protected in the state. They're, again, on the endangered list. So that's not really a feasible option. They cannot be moved. I'm aware that it's one single wolf pack that's been doing the depredation on those three elk that we talked about. So on a bright note, they are finishing up trapping efforts in Kentucky for this year, and hopefully we'll be bringing in another supplement of elk. And you know, that it's hard. You know, elk are getting reintroduced, dropped into a new habitat, learning to, you know, defend themselves or protect themselves and their calves. So we just need to kind of see how things all play out here.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Tom. Eric and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Eric. Let's hold on a second here. Oh, for goodness sakes. Let's see. How do I do these things? I'm fooling around with our screen here. For those of you listening and wondering, what the heck is Larry doing? Here's Eric and Rhinelander. Hi, Eric. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Just got a question. I've been getting some trail camera pictures of some bobcats in the area. It might be one bobcat with radio collars on it. Is Rhinelander area doing a study on them, or is that something further away doing a study on them?
No, there is an active study going on bobcats, and it's through the Department of Natural Resources and their fur bearer researcher. I would guess if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website and type in research and bobcats, you might get a little, at least a project summary of the work that's going on. But there have been numerous press releases or calls through the Trappers Association that if trappers trapped a bobcat, that they would call the researcher to be able to come in and capture it, just in terms of putting a radio collar on it. So that bobcat's likely part of that study, and that's been headed up by Nathan Roberts, our fur bearer researcher.
I would bet also if you called Rhinelander DNR office,
yeah,
they would
be aware.
They'd be aware of it, and they'd probably be more than happy to share information with you.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Okay.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate the call. And now let's turn to Richard in Colfax. Richard, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to tell you about a couple observations. I did get a picture of four kitten bobcats this summer, and female, but on a different date, the different camera. But what I saw last week one day was unbelievable, and my camera was out in the car. I live on the Red Cedar River, and I was saw an immature bald eagle land in the middle of the river, and then two-year-old tom turkeys came out to it and displayed right up close to it within 2 or 3 feet, going around it with their tails spread, you know, and dancing. And that eagle just looked at him. He never made a pass at him. I think he was dumbfounded. And then a coyote came out from the shore and beelined right at all three of them. Well, the eagle took off right away, and the turkey stood there and watched this coyote come to within like 6 or 7 feet, and then they took off, and one flew up in a tree on each side of the river.
that's a neat story. Who needs TV when you've got things like that?
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, that's an awesome story.
Oh, thanks, Richard, for sharing it. Boy, yeah, that would have been something to have had a photo.
Oh,
or,
I know. But all right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with us. Oh, man. Well, it's getting to be that season, isn't it?
When is
the turkey season first?
The youth hunt is, I want to say, like the 9th
of
like April.
April. Yeah.
April 9th,
and then the next Wednesday starts the series of the different periods.
So Mary Jane, oh, I'm sorry.
I was just saying, coming up fast. Yep.
Yeah, coming up fast. Mary Jane and Blue Mounds, your turn next. Let's see. Let's get you on here. Hi, Mary Jane. Thank you for calling.
No, thank you for taking the call. This may be a little bit out of your area of expertise, but I live out in the Blue Mountains area, out in the country, lots of land and trees. I feed the birds every winter, and I've occasionally had a sharp-shinned hawk as a visitor, but now this hawk has become a daily visitor and seems to think that my bird feeding area is a bird banquet area.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit disconcerting to see blood underneath the feeder area in the morning. Is there anything I can do to protect my birds from, the birds from the hawk? I know the hawk has to eat too, but is there anything I can do?
Well, Mary Jane, thanks for the call, and I do appreciate your perspective, but another perspective or another way to look at it is it is a bird feeder after all, and even though this particular hawk is not eating seeds that you're putting out, it is eating the birds that are coming for the seeds, and as you mentioned correctly, every animal has to eat, and it may not be as pretty as watching a cardinal or a chickadee eat seeds from your feeder, but and it is most likely either a sharp-shinned hawk or Cooper's hawk. So those are the two species of hawks that are – they're a smaller hawk in the group we call excipiters. That those two hawks are more common to come to bird feeders and eat other smaller birds like, chickadees and robins and things of that nature. And so I guess I would suggest you don't do anything. And this bird is obviously focused in on your feeders and has realized now that there's a pretty easy meal there. So it would be similar to us driving through the McDonald's drive-through and, ordering a meal and be on our way. So I would encourage you, maybe even though it may be unpleasant to watch or to see the after effects of it, I would encourage you to maybe not to do anything because it is feeding that particular hawk. But if it's something that you don't want to, you can't stomach anymore, or you don't have the tolerance for it anymore, the best thing to do is just take your feeders down for a couple weeks and let everything kind of lay low for a while. And then after a couple of weeks, put the feeders back up and just kind of be observant about what's going on. And even though the concern obviously is if you take your feeders down, the birds that have been coming to the feeders, what will they do? They have got plenty of food out and about, and they may go to another feeder nearby. But again, you know, we've had a pretty mild winter, and the natural food sources are not lacking right now either. So if you don't want to deal with this at all, the easiest solution is just take all of your feeders down for a couple of weeks.
There you go.
Bill, the hawk seems to startle the birds, and they fly into the window. And I've covered the windows with plastic screening that hangs out away from the window,
yep,
so that the birds don't fly into the windows. The only thing I did think of was the old-fashioned corn cribs that are kind of a wire structure with a rough, round, you know, structure.
Yeah.
If I could find an old, used one and put the feeding area inside it. I don't know if the birds would go in there and the hawk wouldn't be able to get them in there. I don't know.
Possibly. Another thing, Mary Jane, you brought up, the birds colliding with windows. So if some of them are dying because they're colliding with windows or getting injured, then some of the recommendations that have come out with locations or how close to place feeders is to either place your feeder within 3 feet of the window or greater than 30 feet away from the window. And the thought with that is if a bird is at a feeder 30 feet away from a window and is scared by a hawk or a cat or whatever it might be, it has enough room or distance to maneuver before it finds the window. Or if the feeder is within 3 feet of the window, if that bird flushes and flies into the window, it's with not enough force to cause injury to the bird. So you might just think a little bit about the distance your feeders are placed and adjust that as well to help if window collisions are an issue.
There you go.
But the other thing is, you know, the birds of the feeders, if they start seeing a predator around regularly, they're going to also start to get pretty vigilant, and they may issue an alarm call and start fleeing before the hawk comes through as well. So there, you know, there's a couple of things that the birds might adapt. You could adapt some of the things you're doing, or you could do nothing at all.
Good luck. Thanks, Mary Jane, for calling. Christina in Glenwood City, we turn to you next. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you. I am calling regarding what I have done to prevent any issues with my feeders. I planted an arbor right near a tree where the feeders are located, and then I put two honeysuckle vines on the either side of them. And I'm telling you, I have seen sharp-shinned hawks come by and try to get to my feeder, and the birds just make a beeline for that honeysuckle vine. The sharp-shinned tries. He cannot get through it and just completely gives up. So it'll come around maybe once a year, but after that, I mean, the hawk knows it just can't get to those birds, so it doesn't bother him anymore.
Very cool. Yep. Idea.
Yep, that was a very good idea. Absolutely. As long as it's a native honeysuckle.
Yes, yeah. It certainly is.
Okay, great.
And right. Not only that, you get the advantage of the hummingbirds as well.
Yep, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, that's a great solution. Thanks, Christina.
Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Yeah, appreciate the call. John in Genoa, we're on to you now. Hi, John. Thanks very much for calling.
I just had a comment or a question. A couple of days ago, my wife was heading north towards La Crosse, and she saw an animal across the road, went up on the bank, and it stood there. So she got a good look at it, and she came home, and she asked me if there's such a thing as a black fox. And I said, well, it may, you know, probably isn't impossible, but I doubt it. But she said it had a bushy tail, but it was coal black, and the only thing I could come up with is maybe it was a fisher. I got a picture of a fisher, and she said, yeah, it looks something like that. So are they coming further south? Are fishers moving into this area?
Yeah, and the
lacrosse. Pardon?
No, thanks for the observation, John, and the call. I think a fisher is a very likely candidate for that sighting, especially the way she described it. You know, a raccoon can be dark in color too, but they're not going to be as athletic as what a fisher or a fox might be. We have red fox and we have gray fox. The grays can be certainly darker, but not jet black like that. So I think a fisher is a reasonable guess at that or identification. And as far as fishers in the state, they're primarily in the northern and central forests and doing quite well. There are harvest seasons on them for trapping. But they have also shown up in other parts of southern Wisconsin occasionally as well. So certainly not an unexpected occurrence. So.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, when we hear a lot of the fishers moving south, they do seem to be moving through that Mississippi River Valley.
Yeah,
right
the
there.
River
so,
corridors.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be that would certainly be a good location to see one in the southern part of the state.
Absolutely. John, thanks. Yeah. Appreciate the call. You can join on in as well. We have open lines again. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question. And if you got a wildlife photo, we'd love to have that as well on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and I hope you'll join in. Kevin in Tomahawk called, couldn't stay with us, though. He was involved in the rescue of two bear cubs whose mother was killed. They took the cubs to a rescue service, but wonder if you guys know of a den where they could take the cub to be fostered.
So, Kevin, I'm not sure whether the state would do something like that or not. I'm really not sure of the protocols with abandoned bear cubs, but there certainly would be licensed facilities that would be able to care for those animals. So my guess is they ended up in the best possible place at a wildlife rescue center or a wildlife rehabilitator. And that person will be well informed about what the options are for returning those animals either to a den or just simply taking care of them at the facility.
There's a nice story in our Wisconsin magazine this month about in the February-March issue about a family that discovered a denned mom and three cubs, mm-hmm. and they didn't disturb it, but went to the DNR, and the DNR was really interested because they're doing some research.
Yep.
So they had lots of photos and a kind of a cool story about what all went on with that.
Yeah, and this is the time of the year where the sows are having their
their
young,
yep.
So it's really quite amazing, but they give birth to very, very small cubs at this time of the year and keep them warm, and they nurse and emerge in April, and
yep. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it is.
It is
very.
Well, they got to hug the cubs because they needed
you
to have
keep
they
them warm.
They had
so.
To keep them warm.
Right.
So
good photo ops.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's some good photo ops there. That's pretty cool. We have Neil in Wright, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. Say, I just wanted to comment on the black fox.
Yeah.
And there is a black fox. It's called a silver fox. It is black, and the tips of the hair are maybe a little bit of white or a little silver on it.
Yep.
But I've seen them, and I didn't think they existed either until I seen one. My neighbor seen it, and then I seen it, and it looks black.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, we have in the state here, obviously you're calling from Minnesota, so you're not much different than we are in Wisconsin, but it's red fox or gray fox are the two species of fox we'd have in the state, and especially with the red fox, they do seem to have quite a few color patterns. I mean, red is obviously the most common, so you have that red with the bushy tail and the white tip to the tail and the black legs, but you do get this like this silver cross fox and the filbert foxes you mentioned and things like that. So you will occasionally see some different pelage colors, and when you see them, they really do stick out, and they kind of make you look a second time like it looks like a fox, but it's not the normal coloration you see. But they are some of those off colors are really pretty stunning.
Yeah, they are. Thanks, Neil, for calling. Jim in Stone Lake, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah. I was wondering if I haven't seen very many snowshoe hare tracks in the last 5 or 4 years, and I wonder if their cycle going down or what.
So, Jim, I'm not exactly sure where their cycle is, kind of currently, but they do tend to cycle. I know with the really warm December we had, there were so many more reports of weasels this year. I don't know if you paid attention to any of that in the news, but with snowshoe hares and weasels, and, of course, they're solid white at that time and on a brown landscape, so there were a lot more folks reporting weasel sightings and snowshoe hares, but in general, I really don't know what that trend looks like. But they are
it
a
is
species
true.
That cycles.
Yeah, it does
yeah,
cycle.
Yeah, and there are species we're kind of watching in terms of climate change and what the effects might be on wildlife as well. If they end up shifting their range further north because they're so dependent on snow for the camouflage with their pelage coloring, so.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting studies going on. And as a matter of fact, a couple of our colleagues in our department, John Pauley and Ben Zuckerberg, are starting to look at some of this stuff with another colleague of theirs. But because of the warming winters and the warming trend, that when those snowshoe hares are white, they rely on that snow cover to for the camouflage, as Jamie alluded to. But when you have warmer winters where the snow's melting or you don't get as much snow cover and there's patches of brown, then those white snowshoe hares really stand out, especially to the predator community. And so they're starting to, some of our colleagues are starting to look at how climate change and warming winters could affect perhaps the range of snowshoe hares, the sustainability of the populations, and things like that. And it is pretty interesting to really start thinking about when they lay out some of the facts for this kind of a story.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin today with Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and the University of Wisconsin Extension. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we look at wildlife issues here in Wisconsin with Jamie Nack and David Drake. Really happy to have them along as well. And Dave in Evansville has a question. Let's go there. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. A couple years ago, some funny activity was going on in one of my lilac bushes. And so I got the camera out and I videotaped the thing. And we looked it up, my wife and I, and it was a shrike. Well, I didn't even know what a shrike was until that day, but it's called a butcher bird, and I lived south of Stoughton. I was just wondering how common they are.
Yeah, Dave, so now you do know what a shrike is, obviously, and they are really, really neat birds. What time of the year did you see the shrike?
It was a very cold winter.
Yeah, okay, so the reason I ask is we have two species of shrike in the state of Wisconsin. One's the northern shrike and one's the loggerhead shrike. And so the northern shrike is the one that is here during the winter, and that's most likely the one that you saw. The loggerhead shrike will come back when the weather's a little bit warmer. But, yeah, they're really, really neat birds. And as you mentioned, and we've alluded to this in past shows with Larry here, is they are the butcher bird because a lot of times they will catch a mouse, for example, or a grasshopper, and they'll impale it either on a thorny bush or on barbed wire fences or something like that. And so that's when you see that prey item impaled on a thorn or the barbed wire fence, you know that a shrike is in the area. And they are really, really neat birds, very very maneuverable, good flyers, you know, just kind of interesting-looking birds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a video of it doing its thing with a chickadee. It's flipping it right up in the crotch of a tree, and the feathers were flying, and not good for the chickadee.
No, it's not.
That's really cool.
But everything has to eat, as we've talked about a couple callers ago.
That's right. It's the chain of life.
It is.
Yeah, it is. And if you want to post that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, I'd love to see it myself.
Yeah, for sure.
It'd be great Yeah, Dave, if you can do that, go to the Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show, and you should be able to post that video right there. I bet a lot of people would take a look at that. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Alan Kakana up next. Hi, Al.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I don't know if either one of your guests ever answered my question, but I put in for my bear permit for my tag for this upcoming fall. And I was just wondering if either one of your guests knew when the permits were going to be issued or, you know, what the lottery drawing was going to be for that.
Hey, Al, thanks for the question. And it's pretty timely. This information has just recently been announced. So if you applied and met the December deadline, you'll be notified by early to mid-February whether you've received a kill permit for this fall. And I guess I should be clear that if you'll be notified if you received a kill permit. They don't notify everybody who's unsuccessful, but just whether you've received a kill permit. And the state just recently, or the Natural Resources Board, just approved a record 11,530 bear harvest permits with a harvest goal of 4,750 bears for the upcoming 2016 hunting season. So that's just a slight uptick from last year. have a pretty stable bear population and lots of opportunity. In fact, the last 7 seasons in Wisconsin have been record harvests, and we enjoy one of the or the highest harvest rate in the U.S.
That's got to be somewhere 40% or 45%.
Yeah, so
success?
I think success rate ticked down just a little bit this last year. So the way they calculate the quota or the available permits is looking at the average of the past 3 years of success rates in a given zone and use that to then determine what the permits will be and what the quota is. So in the state right now is estimating the population to be about 23,000 animals.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Al, for calling. And by the way, while we're at it, permits are going to be coming out for turkey hunters as well.
Yeah, turkey permits should be in your mailbox.
Not in mine.
Soon. Maybe the snow held him up, Larry.
Oh, well, I'm hoping. I'm going to have to get on the phone and call otherwise and make sure that
there will be lots of opportunity for over-the-counter purchases. Yep, so tune into
permits,
that if with extra permits, if you didn't get one or you'd like another one, you can just kind of follow when they become available for the various zones and time periods.
And what about the early for children? Do you have to – do you have to apply early for that, or do you?
I'm not exactly sure how the mentored or the learn to hunt works, but they still would need to purchase a permit.
Of course. Rick in Minocqua, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hey, Larry. Thanks, Jamie and David, for taking calls. I've got a couple questions for you guys. First, I have a farm in New Glarus, but we have a little cabin up in Minocqua, and just before the lake's frozen, as you guys may know, the lake's froze and then thawed out and then refroze. But I stopped into McDonald's on Highway 51 for some coffee, and out of the corner of my eye, I see what looked like a rat or a similar size creature crawling in the parking lot towards the highway. And I put the car in park and I got out, and it looked like a muskrat. It had a hairless tail, and it looked like, you know, a large rat. And instead of letting it walk onto the highway and get hit by a car, I had some thick leather gloves on, so I kind of moved it with my foot towards the gutter and reached down and grabbed it by the back of the neck, and my other hand grabbed the rear section, turned it upside down. It tried to bite me a little bit, but then it kind of relaxed, and I didn't quite know what to do with it, so I took it about, I'd say 3 or 4 blocks to some grove of pine trees, and I let it go, but I wasn't sure what to do, and would you have any suggestions about what might have happened to that animal, or what would be the best way to handle that if that ever happens again?
Well, Rick, you should have gotten a free coffee for your efforts, at the very least. Muskrats are a very, very common animal in Wisconsin. We don't see them terribly often. Sometimes you'll see them swimming in open water. You're more likely to see their lodges, especially in cattail marshes. They'll have mounded cattails that have been cut. And they're a pretty common species, fur bear species that's trapped. And their fur is a very, very nice fur to have as a type of pelt. It's not uncommon for them to get hit by roads because our state is so crossed by roads, and they've got to cross a lot of roads to get to wetlands, and they're a mobile species and things like that. So, you probably did the right thing if you wanted to do something of that nature. Technically, if you pick up a live animal like that, you're supposed to have a permit to do so and to move an animal. So don't give your full name so that you're not identifiable right now. But and they are a wetland species, so probably the best thing if you wanted to do anything is to move them to a wetland. But that certainly will not guarantee that as soon as you drop them, they're not going to head back toward the same direction they came from and try to get across that road and things of that nature. So it's kind of you to try to protect an individual, but even if that one individual got killed, the population is in really, really good shape, and one or a couple individuals getting killed like that is not going to harm the population at all. But from that individual standpoint, I'm sure that individual appreciates your efforts.
There you go.
Another question I had is, as I drove back to the cabin, the Tomahawk River was open, and everything else had frozen. But I would have had to take him a couple of miles and drop him at the Tomahawk River. But I didn't know if he had family or a den that he would have been separated from. So I was not sure. I I felt maybe I just ought to give him another chance to make a different direction, and that's what I did.
Yep. Yeah, so muskrats are they're an aquatic rodent species, and you know, rodents are very social animals, so it is a it lives in a family structure in that lodge or in that muskrat house. And so you probably did the right thing.
Yep. Well,
one more question. I down at the farm this summer had a beautiful, large, healthy gray-brown squirrel found under about a 60 or so foot series of pine trees, and clearly had not been ill. It appeared to have fallen from the tree and landed on one of the farm roads. And I just wondered, those squirrels, if you watch them, are tremendous skilled athletes and acrobats as they go from tree to tree, and it's amazing to watch them. They're tremendously confident and able. Often, is pilot error a significant cause of mortality for those animals?
I'm not sure pilot error, so to speak, you know, quote unquote, is, but certainly they do die from accidents like falling and missing branches and things like that. So it's probably not terribly common, but it does happen.
Well, and it's really hard to document that, because when an animal, you know, if that and when that would happen, it's probably getting scavenged really quickly by something else coming by. But I was I saw a squirrel in all of its gymnastics fall from a tree and probably a good 30 feet up, hit the ground and ran off like nothing happened. So I think they're resilient to some of that, too. Heavy leaf litter in this case. But I think when they do, it's...
I actually observed in Watertown, I was watching across the street, there was the second story of a house, the squirrels, there were a couple of them playing, and they were jumping off, and then coming around and climbing back up and jumping again. So, I mean, and that had to be 30 feet.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
just playful.
Yeah.
So they can survive a pretty, pretty big fall. Well, I'll tell you what, thanks, Rick, for calling. I appreciate it very much. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests, they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back with our guests. So please stay back with us. We'll be right back with David and Jamie. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking today with Jamie Nack and David Drake of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and also UW Extension. Great to have them along as we talk about wildlife with you, and I hope you'll join in. Questions, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. If you've got a photo, wildlife photo, we'd love to have you post that. Maybe a question as well on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Somebody asked us about owls, and this is kind of a interesting time of the year for owls, isn't it, David?
It is. It for sure is. So owls are just a fascinating, you know, group of animals to begin with. But you probably have heard great horned owls, which are the hoot 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 hoot, or the barred owl, which is who cooks for you, who cooks for you all, or possibly the screech owl, which sounds a little bit like a whinnying horse, or, as its name suggests, a screeching bird. And so all those species are found in our state. The great horned owls are nesting right now. They're one of the earliest nesting bird species in the state, and so they're actually laying eggs as early as late January. You know, the couple things about owls, we've got a 19 or so in North America, 19 different owl species in North America. About six of those species nest in Wisconsin. We've got a few more that will occasionally come into our state. The snowy owl is probably the most common visitor from up north, but occasionally the hawk owl or the great gray owl will come into our state as well. We've got, you know, the owls are mostly nocturnal, so they've got a lot more rods in their eyes, so they can see in the black. You know, they're more black and white vision because they're looking more during the dark times of the evening. They're primarily what we call, you know, raptors, so they're predatory birds. They eat, you know, mice and snakes and occasionally other birds and rabbits and things like that. And one of the things about owls, they cannot digest a lot of that fur or those bones, and so they will form what's called an owl pellet and then essentially regurgitate or throw up that owl pellet. And so if you see a grove of pine trees, owls a lot of times will roost in those pine trees. And if you want to go down on the ground floor or the ground underneath the pine trees and look around for kind of an oblong-looking thing that's matted together with fur and perhaps feathers and bones, that would be an owl pellet.
Yep.
But, yeah, they're just fascinating animals and really neat to see. And A lot of times if you go out and you try to call for them at night, you'll hear them calling back, or right now, again, because they're mating and defending territories. You know, we'll hear them a lot of times as we're falling asleep in our bedrooms. So just neat animals.
You wonder why they've chose the winter time to have their young.
Yeah, you know, a lot of it is timing. So if they can get a jump on other animals, for one thing, and then they don't have to compete with all those other animals trying to feed their young. So that's one of the things. But also, as they're starting to feed their young, you know, a lot of other animals are having young here pretty soon, and then there's going to be an abundance of food on the landscape, and so it's a good time for them to start feeding because it'll be a lot of availability of food.
Arlen in Gillette has a comment. Hi, Arlen. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry and your guests. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got some information here regarding the black fox. Leonard Lee Rue is a pretty respected name.
Yep.
When it comes to wildlife, and I'm looking at one of his books here as we speak, his books on fur-bearing animals in North America, and this is what he says. There are four distinct color faces of the red fox, and one of those is a black fox.
Yep.
And another one is the silver fox, which is nearly all black, it's just that it's got silver tips. But black is definitely a color phase of the red fox.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
There's another one, the cross fox, and that has, it's a reddish-colored fox, like the red fox, but it's got dark markings across its shoulders and down its back, and it's called the cross fox. So you're right. Those are all color phases of the red fox. Usually in Wisconsin, we see just the red and then the other species, the gray fox. Those color phases are seen more prevalent in Canada and Alaska for the fox, but not unheard of. I know there was one that was circulating around by email of a cross fox that was from Wisconsin, that was taken in Wisconsin. So,
a red fox can be the mother of a black fox.
Sure, they're the same species. Yeah. So.
Yep. The same species, yep. So it just yep. that
produce
color
the
phase.
Different coloring.
Yep, that's
yep.
right.
Yep, no problems. Thanks, Arlen. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Rick in Green Bay next. Rick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I live on the bay and look out on the ice in the springtime when there's still a shelf of ice out there, but there's open water further out, and I see eagles that'll land on the ice, and also I see coyotes crossing the ice. And one time looking through the spotting scope, I saw a coyote challenge an eagle for his fish. And I watched that for, quite a while, and then I couldn't just sit there. But they were in a standoff for about an hour, and when I came back and looked, I saw two coyotes, no eagle, but no indication of a dead eagle. So I just wonder if this would be common for a coyote to challenge an eagle or...
Mm.
Yeah, Rick, thank you very much for your call. So coyotes are very opportunistic animals, and they will take advantage of food sources that are available to them or you know, similar to what you saw and described, maybe given to them. And so if they can get that fish from that eagle, they certainly are going to do so. But the issue then is, will the eagle attack the coyote trying to get the fish back? And that's the risk that the coyote runs, is being out in that open landscape, that the eagle certainly could come back down on the coyote and try to get the fish back. But coyotes are very, very opportunistic, and if they get the opportunity to snatch a meal, they certainly will do so.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yvonne in Lake Geneva, thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I love your show, first of all. But
thank you.
The reason I wanted to call in is I wanted to make sure people knew that there is a resource available to them statewide. They're called Licensed Wildlife Rehabilitators. These are professionals who provide medical and rehabilitative care for animals like the squirrel that might fall from the tree or the muskrat by the side of the road. And all of these people have been trained, inspected, and tested before they are given a license that allows them to provide this professional care at no cost to a member of the public. And we are available 365 days a year. We are located all over the state, and we take in at least 20,000 animals annually from the citizens of Wisconsin and return them to the wild. So if people aren't aware of that resource, I hope that they will be. And there is a list of rehabilitators on the DNR website. And so there's going to be one in your area.
Thank you very much. That's great. And I was thinking about mentioning that on the muskrat call. But we also, so that's excellent information to get out there in terms of the wildlife rehabbers that are out there. It's important that you know that they are licensed. There's requirements that they have to follow. They are professionals. And there is a directory on the DNR's website if you find yourself in a situation where you think you have an abandoned or an injured animal. It's also kind of coincides with an effort or a campaign effort going on right now between the Department of Natural Resources, Wildlife Rehabilitators. It's something I'm involved with UW Extension, called Keeping Wildlife Wild. And what we're trying to do is get the word out in terms of when it's appropriate to step in and help wildlife and when they're doing what they normally would be doing and they're best to just be observing from a distance. So sometimes it's better to call and ask and inquire before you take that animal from the wild and take it to a rehabilitator. Go ahead and call the rehabber or call the DNR and find out what the best course of action is. So I'd also encourage listeners to go and check out Keep Wildlife Wild and learn a little bit about baby animals, especially with the upcoming spring in a few months, you know, how best to proceed when you encounter perhaps an orphaned animal or an injured animal.
And we do have scheduled a wildlife rehabilitator. Brianne, I don't remember exactly when, but it's coming up. Marge Gibson.
Oh, perfect. She's wonderful.
Is going to be on the show for probably a Wednesday,
yeah,
I'm sure.
That'll be a great show.
Yeah, she's been a guest in the past, but not for a long time. So we decided better bring her back. So, Yvonne, thanks for the reminder, and I hope you'll stay listening. Marge will be on coming up pretty soon, actually. We'll find out. We'll find out and get back to you. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it very much. And Judy in Racine has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Judy.
Hi. We feed the birds, and, of course, we also feed the squirrels. And yesterday we noticed one of our squirrels, I don't know if it might have, can a hawk go after a squirrel? He's got injuries on his, on both sides, more on the left side than the right. And we can see there's a little spot where you can see the bone. He seems to be functioning okay, but we were just curious if a Cooper's hawk could do that or something else.
They certainly could. Squirrels are a pretty formidable prey, though. They can be pretty feisty and difficult. So a lot of times it is a more of an adult bird that might try to take a squirrel. They're a lot more difficult than say a rabbit would be or a small bird. There are other animals that could potentially injure a squirrel, or there could have been, you know, some interspecies stuff going on. Who knows? But certainly it's a possibility that a hawk might have caused that injury.
Okay. Otherwise, maybe a dog or a coyote or
a cat.
Yeah. Any number of things.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rick in Portage County, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hey. Hi, Larry. I have a question about snapping turtles.
Okay.
It seems almost uncanny in my lifetime how many snapping turtles I've come across frozen in the middle of the road, you know, all pulled in and into their shell. And I've stopped and taken numerous ones off the road and put them off on the side. And, you know, you only pick them up once. You only make the mistake once of picking them up by the shell between the legs.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so I picked them up by the tail and held them away from me and put them off to where I thought they were, you know, they weren't in as much danger. But someone mentioned to me that you can damage them that way. And if so, is there a correct way or a better way to pick them up to move them off the road?
Yeah. So Rick, it must be Rick Day, because I think this is the 10th Rick we've had call in today. So, Rick, that's a really good question. And what you, Rick, mentioned is you only make the mistake once of picking them up in between the legs, because they have very sharp claws. And when you pick them up on the side of the shell, the back legs will start clawing at your hands. And all of a sudden, you've got a decision to make. Do I drop this thing, or do I just sustain the claw scratches and get rid of this, move it as fast as I can? And snapping turtles are the largest turtle species we have in the state of Wisconsin, and they can get pretty dang heavy. So picking it up by the tail or by the back legs can cause some damage to that animal's body. And so the better way to do it is to pick it up by the top shell right behind the head, and then so you put one hand right behind the head at the top shell, and then you put the other hand back on the top shell, back by the tail, and you can pick that animal up and safely move it. And by handling it from the top shell, you know, the claws are still, the feet are still moving, the claws are not concerned to you. And that animal, it is pretty quick with the head, and they can turn their head surprisingly far distance from side to side, but they can't get your hand when you've got it right at the base of the neck. And so that's probably the better way to do it, and or the way I do it. I don't know, Jamie, if you have any other suggestions?
Well, my suggestion is don't pick it up at all. Just get a big get a big stick and put it in front of the its mouth, its beak, and let it bite the stick, and then try to drag it across. So you don't take that chance whatsoever, you know, at all.
But I would not.
I don't want to try it. Well, let's try this.
You definitely do not want to get caught.
Just try to just use a stick or a shovel if you have one in your vehicle, and just try to scoot it across the road.
Yep.
There we go. Thanks, Rick, for calling. And you know, coyotes have come up more than once, and I have meant all along during the show to bring up the video that you were involved with, David, about coyotes and hazing coyotes.
Yep. So, as you know, we've talked about this a number of times. We've got a project going on here called the UW Urban Canid Project, where we are live trapping and radio collaring red fox and coyotes in the city of Madison to study how these animals interact between the two species, but also how fox and coyote kind of navigate these urban landscapes. And especially with coyotes, that they can, they act like coyotes, and they're predatory animals. And last fall, we had a number of incidents here on the east side of Madison where at least four dogs were taken and killed by a pack of coyotes over in that area. And so to the credit of Madison and Dane County Public Health Department, they were very proactive and went about and started, they created a YouTube video called How to Haze a Coyote. And so it's gotten great reception. You can find it by just Googling YouTube and How to Haze a Coyote Dane County or something of that nature.
It's on our Facebook page.
It's on the Facebook page. I think
it's the Larry Mueller Show.
Been seen by maybe 15,000 people. And the idea is, the best thing to do for coyotes, especially coyotes that live amongst the human beings, is to make them fearful of us. And the best way to do that, and the safest way to do that, is to haze them by scaring them, either shaking a can of pennies at them, or yelling at them and waving your arms, or throwing sticks or stones, not at the animal to hit the animal, but in the direction of the animal. And I think one of the reasons that this video has gotten such good reception is because it's a bit campy. You see a very stiff me there talking about it, but then there's a very animated woman who does a phenomenal job in the video, kind of demonstrating some of the things we talk about in the video. And so that is the best thing you can do is to make coyotes and really any wildlife around us fearful of us. And that is the best thing you can do so we have peaceful coexistence between the wildlife species and the human species.
Yeah. And that How to Haze a Coyote, again, if you go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you can watch it right there. Mary in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I have a question about owls. About a month ago, midday, maybe 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, we went outside, and sitting on our patio deck and looking in the window at us was maybe a 10-inch high owl, and we were told it was the eastern, I think it's screech owl in its red phase. And is this normal for owls to sit up there and to look at us and then follow us? I mean, when we walked around inside, his head was just going back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, so, oh, I'm sorry, Mary, excuse me.
Why would he be outside in the middle of the day?
Well, so owls, we do think of them as primarily nocturnal, and they really are, but we do have some owl species like the snowy owl that can be more diurnal, where it's active during the day or as active during the day as it might be during the night. But we have other owls that are what we call crepuscular, which are active more around sun up and sun down. And occasionally animals will kind of get out of that cycle a little bit for whatever the reason might be. And maybe there was just something so interesting in your house going on that it wanted to peer in there and see what the heck you were doing.
well, actually, the problem we have with our porch is that it's glassed in. It's three sides, and birds all frequently fly into it.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if maybe we saved, by going out there, he didn't bother flying through. Well, thank you very much for
the information. And as usual, it's an interesting and educational show.
And Mary, the only thing maybe as an add-on here is if you do have glassed-in porch and you've got birds flying into it, is to try to break up that reflection somewhat. And there's a number of ways to do that. If you go to the American Bird Conservancy, they've got wonderful tips on there about how to prevent birds from flying into glass windows and things like that. But I would take a look at that and maybe see if you can modify that glass surrounding a little bit so that you can prevent birds from continuing to fly into those windows.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Mary. And Scott in Watertown, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I had kind of an unusual wildlife sighting, at least I think it is, for this time of year. I was out walking through a field and a couple days after this last bitter cold spell, and there was a little spring-fed creek, and I flushed a woodcock. And I'm thinking, how can this woodcock survive the winter? I know that its bill is primarily designed for eating earthworms, and just curious as to how unusual it would be for a woodcock not to migrate and what kind of things that it could feed on in that little narrow strip of open ground next to this creek to survive the winter.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right, Scott. That is pretty unusual. They are a migrant, so we would not expect them at this time. And yet we see situations with that, whether it's robins or bluebirds, or I know there's a post here about a brown thrasher, you know, birds that typically, usually migrate even short distances, but they're staying or choosing to stay year-round. So it's hard to say. There could be an injury there. It was also a very warm winter up to the last couple weeks. We haven't had a lot of snowfall. It's not surprising that you came across it by a spring. So it probably has, there's not frozen ground there, and it's able to continue to forage. Why it decided to stay, I'm not sure we'll ever really know.
No.
One thing you could do, just this would be something I would do if I was sitting at the office, is go on to Wisconsin eBird. And it's a website that you're able to, through citizen science recordings, but you can drill down into the data and you could type in woodcock and then narrow it down to this time of the year during the winter months and see if there have been other sightings. They would certainly be uncommon, but you would be able to see if there were other sightings.
You could post your own.
Yep, yeah. And you could post your own sighting. Yep.
On eBird. That'd be great, as a matter of fact.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, Scott, for calling. Stephen Duran wonders about eagle watching and eagle photography, and we've got some good spots for that, have we not?
Yeah, the bald eagle watching days are, I'm thinking...
They're over.
Are they over? January, but January, yeah. February is prime time with, if you can find some open water, but Prairie du Sac,
Sauk City.
Sauk City.
Yep, really good, and I see you're a 715 area code, so I'm not exactly sure where Duran is, but...
That is in northern
Wisconsin, but you may want to just Google, you know, eagle watching and your area and see what comes up. Or again, that eBird is another good spot because people will start reporting bald eagle sightings there, and you can look for sightings in your area and then track to those locations.
Sauk City area though is
a really hot spot
for watching it. And finally, Mike wondered about. Or commented that only great horned owls will nest now, not screech owls. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah. So Mike's correct, and if I gave a wrong impression, I apologize. But absolutely, only great horned owls are nesting right now, and then the other species will start to follow soon. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we are. One quick thing in 15 seconds. What do you feed a brown thrasher? Jerry in Amherst says he's got one coming to his feeder.
So this is really interesting. About a month ago, I had a call from a woman, too, who had a brown thrasher. Was very confident in her identification, and I agree with her. I went on eBird and looked, and every now and then there are some reportings over winter. So they are an insect eater primarily, and they will switch over, just like a bluebird might. If it decides to stay the winter, they'll switch over to fruits. But you could also try putting out mealworms if you can find them, and see if the thrasher will pick up on those. But otherwise, native plantings, and they'll come in and eat those fruits in the winter.
Jamie, David, thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Great to have them by. Jamie Nack and David Drake from University of Wisconsin Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department, the University of Wisconsin Extension. David works in there as well. So it's great to have them along. And thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.